Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the horrendous massacre of three Mormon women and six children on a highway in the north of Mexico by suspected members of a drug gang who might have mistaken the convoy of vehicles for a rival cartel. An expert on the drug wars in Mexico that have killed 250,000 since 2007, with an additional 40,000 missing, Joan Grillo joins us from Mexico City. The author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, and his latest, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the Politics of Latin America, will discuss the growing pressure on Mexico's President López Obrador, who was recently humiliated by a brazen attack by 800 cartel gunmen, sicarios, who recaptured Little Chapo, the son of the drug lord El Chapo, from the outgunned Mexican military. Having abandoned the U.S.-backed kingpin strategy, López Obrador, under pressure from Donald Trump, has had to divert the newly created Mexican National Guard away from fighting the drug cartels to policing the southern border with Guatemala to stop refugees from heading to the United States. And since the Sinaloa cartel was able to take over the city of Culiacan with 800 heavily armed gunmen wielding military-style weapons obtained in the NRA's gun-saturated United States, like the 50-caliber rifles that blew off the legs of Mexican soldiers, the kingpin strategy does not appear to be working, as an endless supply of underlings seem ready to take over from the drug lords. Then we'll examine the latest research which indicates the Democrats might be taking false comfort from the polls showing Trump will lose the nationwide vote against the top five Democratic presidential candidates, since Trump's path to re-election via the Electoral College remains secure from all of the Democrats except Joe Biden. David Schultz, a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law, and author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, and American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research, joins us. We'll discuss the problem for Democrats that their candidate most likely to stop Trump's re-election, Joe Biden, is running out of money as his support among the more progressive Democratic primary voters and donors wanes. Then finally, on the day after the Trump administration announced its formal withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accords, we will look into a new report from the Conservation Biology Institute by 11,000 researchers from around the world, published in Bioscience, warning of untold suffering if humanity does not change its ways. Janet Redman, the climate campaign director at Greenpeace USA, joins us to discuss the urgent need to replace fossil fuels, cut emissions of climate pollutants, restore ecosystems, build a carbon-free economy, and stabilize population growth with family planning and girls' education. Before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners who are helping us sustain and build Background Briefing online. We are grateful for the donations from across the nation and around the world coming in at backgroundbriefing.org/donate that keep us corporate-free, fearless, and independent as we weaponize facts against authoritarian fictions to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now from Mexico City is Joan Grillo, who has reported on Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, Reuters, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. And his first book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, was translated into five languages and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. And his latest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
Always good to be here.
Well, thanks, Joan. And every time we talk, it's usually about some outrage in Mexico involving drug violence. But what happened to this Mormon family up near the border with the United States, traveling in a convoy? They live in apparently a big sort of Mormon compound. They were absolutely, the women and children were burned alive. They were shot up and massacred in a convoy. At this point, it does look as if the drug cartels thought it was a rival cartel's convoy. Is that the latest?
Yeah, that's the information we've had. It's very hard to know. You know, when, you know, if you look at some of the details that have been reported, you know, there's of gunmen, you know, executing even people who escaped from the car. So sometimes when people talk about these accidents, you know, in inverted commas, you have to have suspicion, you know, was there really a hit there? You know, and why would they massacre? I mean, obviously very, very brutal, massacring six young children, three adult women in a convoy of vehicles in this way. But the tragedy is these things, accidents is not the correct word, these mistaken identity attacks can happen. I mean, that's, you know, the level of violence we're seeing in Mexico, that, you know, you have cartel gunmen with heavy weapons, you know, using 50 cals, using grenades, using AK-47s, AR-15s, converted to fully automatic, attacking vehicles. And in that part of the country, there's a dispute between two cartels, one in Sonora state, one in Chihuahua state. The Sonora state, which really borders on Arizona, and Chihuahua state, which borders on Texas. And these cartels are fighting over territory and kind of very on hyper alert for any vehicles from rival gunmen. But yeah, I mean, a complete tragedy for the family. And another angle on this is that a member of the extended family called Julian Barón, he had his brother killed back in, I believe, 2009. And he was a very vocal member of a peace movement in 2011. And I used to see him in the plazas around Mexico, a very good voice for change, a very heartfelt voice for change, alongside an activist called Javier Cecilio, whose son was murdered. And, you know, now even worse tragedy has struck his family.
Well, I think the Mormon, the LeBaron family, I guess they've had this compound for some time, going back, I think, to the 19th century. Some of them are relatives of Mitt Romney, as a matter of fact, and he's tweeted out his condolences. Didn't some of the Mormons speak out against drug violence and drug cartels?
Yeah, so it's a community, as you say, going back many generations. It's very much a binational community. So there's a lot of, I think, the extended family members in the United States and in Mexico, crossing, you know, back and forth. And you see some of the, you know, when you hear some of the LeBarons speak, when they speak Spanish, they speak with a perfect Mexican accent, and when they speak English, with an American accent. They're very much kind of binational, with you know, their own community, but moving between these two great nations. And I think they have been victims of violence and kidnapping in Mexico before. You know, they're relatively wealthy in the area. You know, they have some family members who work in the oil industry in Texas, and some of the members in Mexico have been targets of kidnapping, going back. And then have been activists in the peace movement. And I say Julian LeBaron was a very positive, I thought, a very positive voice in the peace movement in Mexico around 2011, a very good, clear voice, actually questioning drug prohibition, among things. So, yeah, you know, a real tragedy for his family.
And apparently some of the victims were visitors from Utah. They weren't even local people.
Yeah, there's still some information about that, and I'm not 100% sure. I think I'd be a bit careful on all of the details about, you know, a lot of the family members are often binational citizens,
sure. So
Mexican and American, and sometimes living between both countries. So that might well be the case. They're actually living in the United States and we're there for a visit, but I'm not 100% sure on those details.
And again, I'm speaking with Johan Grillo, who's joining us from Mexico City. He has reported on Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, Reuters, CNN, the Associated Press, the PBS NewsHour. And his first book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, was translated into 5 languages and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. And his latest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. So let's go back to last month's killings in the Mexican city of Culiacan, where the new leader of Mexico, AMLO, López Obrador, made the humiliating decision to let the son of El Chapo, Ovidio Guzman López, loose after
a very outgunned, outnumbered group of Mexican soldiers escorting him were attacked over, what, hundreds of Sinaloa cartel sicarios, gunmen, who basically took over the whole city, did they not? And the idea that the strategy that the U.S. has been pursuing with Mexico, called the Kingpin strategy, has been abandoned by López Obrador, and the idea that the U.S. has been working with the various Mexican police and military who are tasked with fighting this drug war that has killed more than 250,000 Mexicans since 2007 and left more than 40,000 missing. That has now become a subject of a debate, a pretty contentious one, right? I read a piece by Mexico's former foreign minister, Carlos Castaneda, which very critical of AMLO. So is that a part of this whole story here? It's certainly going to be revived, is it not?
Yeah, no, absolutely. These are all connected. These are not isolated incidents. And you've got to look at this big picture of this violence. I mean, we've had in the last few weeks a series of very high-profile violent incidents. We had a massacre, an ambush and massacre of police in Michoacan with 14 police dead. We had a fight in Guerrero State with a large number dead, mainly killed by the military. We had this uprising in Culiacan, and then this massacre of the Mormon family. Now, the uprising in Culiacan, according to some numbers, one military video put out, there were 700 to 800 gunmen. I mean, quite incredible. In a military a briefing on this, they talked about one single place. There was 150 gunmen who appeared and kidnapped a number of soldiers. So this was a really large-scale incident, quite astounding. Even within the many, many incidents, you know, I've been covering this violent conflict for 18 years, and I really consider the violence to have stepped up since about 2008. So I've been covering this violent conflict for some 11 years, and even within that framework, this is quite an extraordinary incident. The way they took over an entire city, or took it strategically, effectively took it over. So they had they blockaded roads, they attacked military simultaneously at a whole bunch of points. They had gunmen coming down from the hills, from the countryside. They were clearly, openly photographed gunmen taking these places. Some with 50 caliber rifles, firing 50 cal bullets, which one of those blew the leg off a Mexican soldier. So quite an astounding incident, and a very bad precedent. The fact that the president of López Obrador, his government, did give up Chapo San Ovidio Guzmán. Now, in the very moment, it was a difficult decision. They had soldiers captured at gunpoint, saying we're going to kill them. They had gunmen around the family living areas of soldiers. So there's an area where the children and the families of soldiers live, and they had gunmen around there firing into that, saying, we're going to kill you, the families of soldiers. And many regular citizens of Culiacan just feared, with these gunmen everywhere, there could be a massacre of them. I mean, those people who were in Walmart stores, in nurseries, picking up their children, they stayed inside the entire day and even slept overnight in those places. People were taking mattresses from supermarkets to sleep there. So quite an incredible incident, and I think the handling of it by López Obrador was very poor. The follow-up was very poor. I mean, it was a very difficult decision, but since then he gave a bunch of quite contentious press conferences. In one of them, he named the military officer who led the operation as a kind of form of shaming him, saying this was not really us who did this. He was criticized for that, of putting the officer's life in danger. He lashed out at the press in a number of statements, saying that the press were kind of overhyping this, actually challenged some journalists in press conferences about who they work for, saying they're kind of part of the opposition. And then more recently, you've seen on social media a bunch of attacks on journalists, saying journalists are sicarios, like journalists are the hitmen, or journalists are prostitutes, and these are the messages coming out. So quite a tense situation there between the press and the president. And the president, big questions about his security strategy. And, you know, he came to power with a lot of support. He came to power promising peace. He came to power promising that this violence, this war would no longer happen. But unfortunately, it's very hard to stop. And it's like a war that you can't win and you can't get out of. It's a real swamp. And I guess it is also easy for journalists like myself to simply criticize whoever's in power. But it is very tough to how you find a solution to this mess.
Well, the idea that only 35 troops were dispatched, and you said there were up to 800 Sicarios gunmen from the Sinaloa cartel taking over strategic parts of Culiacan. Clearly, they were outgunned. But it also raises the question, which, of course, AMLO himself has raised, about the viability of the Kingpin strategy, because they've obviously got El Chapo in jail here in the United States. But the fact that his son can put together an army like that, that indicates that if you knock off the kingpin, it doesn't mean that you've taken down the cartel. Quite the opposite appears to be the case. And then on top of that, President Trump is forcing AMLO to divert his soldiers to the southern border with Guatemala to stop the flow of immigrants. This new National Guard has been completely co-opted to deal with stopping Central American immigrants, not stopping the drug trade.
Yeah, that's correct. The Kingpin strategy has certainly failed to bring peace, and I've long been a critic of it myself, the fact you, in fact, often just creates more violence. And you see that in Mexico, where you had these powerful warlords, and you kill them, and their lieutenants then become, you know, even more violent to fight amongst themselves. However, at the same time, it's also bad to allow these wanted men to be free, these powerful warlords as cult followings of. You know, if you allow them to be free and don't go after them, that's bad as well, because you're allowing impunity. You're allowing, you know, wanted, blatant criminals with, I hate to use this word, but armies of hitmen. And when you talk about 800, you know, people taking a city, it is a kind of like an uprising, like an insurgency, which is the comparison I used in my first book. So you've kind of got bad options on both sides there. And I think, you know, how do you deal with this? I mean, you know, I've always advocated, you know, like how do you, you know, you need to have a real serious drug policy reform to take their money away. You know, if there's billions and billions of dollars going from Americans buying cocaine, buying crystal meth, buying heroin and buying marijuana, I mean, it's obviously very hurtful to American communities as well, but that money then flows to these people year after year. So some really meaningful drug policy reform and you know, also some very serious kind of prevention programs in these communities, where you have to try and win over the young children who are recruited by cartels, recruited as hitmen, and joined to fight up against the forces of the state, and also build real police forces. So it's a Herculean challenge. Where does that? We've also got the challenge of Central American migrants and refugees streaming through Mexico in very, very big numbers. I mean, with, you know, it's been hundreds of thousands this year. And so Mexico's National Guard, as you say, has been diverted to deporting those forcibly deporting them in many instances.
Well, just in closing, Jan Grillo, let's talk a little bit about how the U.S., basically the DEA and particularly U.S. intelligence assets have been used in all of the important captures of these drug kingpins, and apparently also in the case of Little Chapo, who was freed by the 800 gunmen that he had, and he was under arrest with only 35 Mexican soldiers. Apparently, the U.S. intelligence and DEA intelligence, I guess, don't totally trust the Mexican army. They certainly don't trust the risk-averse federal police. And the only people that they work with or trust are the United States-trained Marines, but they've turned out to be excessively violent. So that seems to be a problem, that the trust factor between law enforcement in the United States and Mexico is very low. And if you use the only people that you trust, the Marines, there's a lot of collateral damage.
Yeah, so in the case of Ovidio Guzman, the arrest order, he was indicted in the United States by a court in Washington for traffic of marijuana, crystal meth, and cocaine. There was information first released about that in February. That actually came down, and was given to this unit, a special unit inside the Mexican army called the G-A-I-N, like GAIN, but it's a special anti-narcotics unit in the army, and they sent people over to Culiacan, who located him. Now, it's unclear if American intelligence actually involved in the location of where he was, of which house he was in, or if that intelligence was gained by this Mexican military unit in the field. Now, because of the problems of corruption and the problems of information being leaked, this unit apparently was not giving the information up to the supreme commanders of the military. They were like taking this order, we've got an indictment of this guy, we're going to go and arrest him. So they went to do it. There was some confusion, in fact, over a house warrant to search the house, search warrant. And as they were surrounding it when the gunman went up against them, that's one of the reasons that they were such a small group. And then some other military units came out or were, in fact, attacked by the cartel military units all around the city. However, the military did hit them back quite hard. Now, it's a tragic situation, but there's no easy answers. You know, when you have the Mexican army, Mexican federal police, Mexican Marines, and all of them being violent, using violence, against criminals and against civilians, so committing massacres, fighting them. Sometimes executing people, basically execution, lining them up and shooting them in the head, or in a firefight, just drawing and then killing them all. In some cases, killing, regular people, in many cases. So that's very bad. However, when you are fighting these gunmen with military-grade weapons, with 50 cals, and there's a quite intense video where they fire a 50 cal and blow a soldier's leg off, there's many cases where these 50 cals to ambush police. Using fully automatic AK-47s, fully automatic AR-15s, when you have that level of firepower, regular police going to suffer as well. So it's kind of like a no-win situation. And again, we've often been calling for many years, the NGOs and journalists like myself saying, well, you have to actually have a proper justice system which ends the impunity and so forth. And obviously that would be what the things we really strive for, but it is a very, very difficult situation to get there. And now almost like a critical situation where the law of order has broken down so much, you almost need some kind of emergency measures before you can establish a regular rule of law in this country.
Sure. And just in closing, we have to thank the NRA in this country for the lax gun laws that allow the Barrett 50 caliber rifle to be sold openly here in the United States, and that's where the Mexican drug cartels get their arms from. I thank you for joining us.
Exactly. If I'm going to just mention, I'm actually just got a new book coming out on gun trafficking and looking at all of these multiple issues of gun trafficking from the United States to Mexico, gun trafficking around the United States to inner cities in the United States, and the weapons that are stolen from the military and from police forces here. I've got a really good deep dive into that whole situation, which is, as you say, a lot of guns coming with the kind of quite crazy myriad of gun laws that are in the United States.
Well, Yohann Grillo, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Yohann Grillo, who is in Mexico City. He's reported on Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, Reuters, CNN, the Associated Press, and the PBS NewsHour. And his first book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, was translated into 5 languages and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. And his latest book is Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. And he's writing a book on the gun trafficking between the United States and Mexico. And, that will mean we'll do another interview when the book comes out. Again, I thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the latest research that indicates the Democrats might be taking false comfort from polls showing Trump will lose the nationwide vote
against the top five Democratic presidential candidates.
Politics needs votes. Politics needs your money. Politics needs human beings. Politics needs lies.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, David Schultz, a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He's the author of 30 books and various articles on American politics, ethics, election law, and the media, and most recently, Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Election Law and Democratic Theory, and his latest, American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Schultz.
Thank you very much.
So there's been some articles and polls recently that indicate that the Democrats might be taking false comfort from national polls that show the top five Democrats beating Donald Trump. Whereas in the Electoral College route to re-election, the only Democrat that looks like he could beat Donald Trump is Joe Biden. And Joe Biden is in trouble, running out of money, and his support amongst the more progressive Democratic voters and donors is waning. So my sense is that the Democrats are in trouble.
Yeah, the Democrats are in trouble. And remember, at the end of the day, it's not about the popular vote. It's about what? It's the race for 270 to get to 270 electoral votes. It's about competition across 50 different states plus the District of Columbia. And we know increasingly in the last few years, it's come down to now just a handful of critical swing states, places such as Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, Pennsylvania. And again, the national polls are suggesting that perhaps Elizabeth Warren, perhaps a Bernie Sanders, perhaps Joe Biden, maybe other Democrats are going to win the national popular vote, much in the same way that Clinton won the national popular vote back in 16. But if it's all about the race for the Electoral College, the best polls are suggesting right now that either the Electoral College is incredibly competitive with only Joe Biden showing a chance of being able to win that, or if we start to look at people like Elizabeth Warren and some of the other Democratic candidates, the Democrats, if they were to pick somebody like her, are in serious danger of losing the presidency again.
Well, I have heard from some of my sources that it was the internal polling in the White House that told Trump that the only person that could that he would win the Electoral College, except he would lose Pennsylvania to Joe Biden. And that preceded the July 25th phone call with Zelensky, which happens to now be the basis of the impeachment. So there's a direct connection there that Trump went after Biden using the Ukrainians for the very reason that he needed to knock him out. And to some extent, he has dirtied up Biden. But what explains why Biden's running out of money and losing support amongst Democrats? Don't Democrats want to win this one badly?
I think they want to win, but we're looking at, let's say, a collective action problem here. And what I mean by that, it might very well be in every Democrat's interest to support the candidate who looks like who's the most winnable candidate, especially in those critical swing states. But as is true with collective action problems,
people are torn in lots of different directions. So you have a Democratic Party that is torn between, let us say, ideologically, a chunk of the party likes the direction where Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are in terms of fairly very progressive set of political issues and agenda. Then you have a party that is also pulled in part towards the more moderate wing, which is the Joe Biden wing, perhaps maybe a Governor Bullock, perhaps Senator Klobuchar. But because there's all these different factions within the party and pulling in different interests, and they happen to be interests that are representing, on the whole, a more liberal agenda than where the voters are in those critical swing states, they are pushing the party towards a set of issues and towards a set of perspectives that, while they may make the Democrats feel great and helping them win the national popular vote, they're not working right now, according to the most recent polls, in terms of helping the Democrats nail down those critical states that they lost 3 years ago or 4 years ago. Because think about it. Had four years ago, for 2016, Clinton had moved Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania over into her column, she would have been president of the United States. We were looking at about 90,000 votes between those three states, but they represented a trove of electoral votes that really cost her the election. And those are going to be among the handful of states that are also going to be critical for 2020. And right now, polls are suggesting that Trump has, against all the candidates except for Biden, good leads, or at least strong enough of leads in those states that the Democrats, were they to pick some of the candidates they're vetting at this point, would not pick those states up and probably lose the election.
And again, I'm speaking with David Schultz, Professor of Political Science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law. He's the author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, and his latest book is American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. So why is it then that there's only Joe Biden who doesn't seem to be that sharp, and we know he's kind of prone to gaffes, but he's still popular, but he's running out of money and running out of support amongst progressives? They much more favor Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. And as we mentioned, he's having problem raising money or spending too much money on jets, etc. What about these others? You mentioned some. Like, for example, I'm mystified why Governor Steve Bullock is not more popular or gaining more traction, because he's a very attractive candidate for the centrist Democrats who are concerned, and I don't think the one in your state is going to do it. She's Amy Klobuchar, I just don't think, is that interesting, although she fills the bill as a centrist. So is it the way the DNC and Perez has structured these debates with, I find them incredibly irritating that half the people shouldn't be there. They're starting to winnow them a little, but they're not. And for example, this billionaire from California, Tom Steyer, who's on this personal ego trip, he's never going to get anywhere, but about $100 million of his is going to be wasted. Why can't he spend a few million on that, give it to Steve Bullock, for God's sake? Bullock's got a chance if he could only get noticed.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because first off, I would say these debates aren't debates. They are media events. They are, we used to use the phrase at one point, they're beauty pageants. They're about one-minute sound bites. So that's the first problem here. They're really not a vetting of the issues. And the victory goes to the person who can get in the 10-second sound bite. So it's almost like the Andy Warhol and, your 15 minutes of fame or something. But second, as you point at here, we have a process that's set up that looks at a combination of fundraising, how many dollars you've generated, how many donors you've generated, as well as your standing in the polls. And the way it's set up, look at it at this point. We've got some candidates who are still in this contest who are barely above 1 to 2% in the polls, but yet they're still being seriously considered as candidates. And so I think this vetting process that was set up is creating major problems, because it's allowing candidates to stay in well beyond what should be their viability stage, and giving to some candidates who are not probably electable some base of support, because they can appeal to enough constituents that are enough people out there just to keep them in the race long enough.
Yeah, like Andrew Yang, who basically is giving a TED talk, which is really interesting. I mean, I love what he has to say, but if this is not a presidential debate, I mean, what's going on here? These aren't.
Yeah, I was going to say, take somebody like him or Marianne Williamson.
Oh, forget about her. I mean, she's got, thank God she's gone.
I can't even understand why she's in this.
Right. Well, but mercifully, she seems to have disappeared. But I think Delaney is actually still in the race, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And then Beto just pulled out. But Steyer is the one that annoys me the most, because there's a massive amount of money being wasted on this ego trip of his, because he started out talking about impeachment, which is good, but he put himself in all the ads, obviously, to get name recognition and to get recognized, and now he's trying to parlay that into a candidacy. But he's wasting all that $100 million of his own money that could be put to better use, and as I say, help a Bullock, and all of them are wasting money, because Trump is just rolling in dough, because there's only one guy, Trump, on one side, and there's endless Democrats on the other.
No, you're right. I mean, if I were somebody like Steyer and I had $100 million, I would put that into supporting who I think is the strongest candidate to win, and I would also be putting that money into what? Into Democratic Senate races, so that the Democrats could also pick up the U.S. Senate.
Right. Well, again, it's an ego-driven beauty contest with people using television to get noticed for whatever reasons, but it has very little to do with who would be the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. And that's what's so strange, David, is that Democrats feel incredibly passionate that you got to get rid of this guy. I do. I believe he's a criminal and a traitor. I think we have the most amazing situation in the history of global politics, frankly, to have as somebody running the United States is actually working for an enemy of the United States. It's just surreal.
No, I agree. I think the Democrats are united behind the idea that Trump has to go. But after we get beyond that, there seems to be no unity on anything in terms of strategy, message, or process for how to go about doing it. And I still come back and say that the fatal flaw with the Democrats is in terms of thinking that what? That it is a popular vote strategy. This was the mistake that Clinton made back in 2016, is that she forgot at the end of the day that it is essentially an electoral college strategy, and the focus has to be on getting to 270 electoral votes. And you need to decide what are the states you need to put together to be able to do that, and she just forgot it. I mean, I think in terms of fatal mistakes that in the last couple of weeks of the election, she didn't travel at all to Wisconsin during the general election. I think only made a fundraising trip to Michigan during it, and instead of going back to those states in the critical last week, she goes off to Texas and Arizona, states that were by far long shots at best for Democrats to win. And what wound up happening, she loses Wisconsin, she loses Michigan. So the Democrats need to be thinking about...
And Pennsylvania. Yeah.
Yeah, and Pennsylvania too. I was going to say, if I were waving my magic wand, I would be setting up a primary process, primary caucus process, and maybe a debate process that winnows people by what? Following the logic of the Electoral College. Now, exactly what that means, I don't know, but I would be thinking in terms of how do we test out the candidates so that they can best survive an electoral college campaign. And Trump, to give him credit, you know, 3 years ago and going into next year, is playing the electoral college strategy. And we could have a great debate about the merits or demerits of the electoral college, but the fact of the matter is that's the constitutional way to win, and the Democrats need to figure that out.
Right, and then just in closing, the added factor that helped Trump get elected was that Hillary Clinton lost by 77,000 votes in those three key states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, whereas the third-party candidate, Jill Stein, got over 120,000 votes in those same states. Not necessarily all of them would have gone to Clinton, but maybe enough of them would. And there's a fear that Tulsi Gabbard may run as a third-party candidate, which would then help Trump even more. So I don't understand why the Democrats, the only chance they have, by the look of it, at this point is Joe Biden. And he's not doing that well. And the other guy that I thought would be really popular with the centrist Democrats, Steve Bullock, he can't even get recognized. And Sherrod Brown, another really good candidate, didn't even want to get into the race because it was so crowded. So it's a goddamn train wreck.
It is. It is. Yeah. And like I said, the simple way of describing it, the center of the Democratic Party is probably further to the left than is the center of where the critical swing states are in the United States. And so long as we have that dichotomy, and so long as the fact that we have the Electoral College, and it's not going away anywhere near in the future, the Democrats may be setting themselves up for a strategy or a process for picking a candidate that's going to produce perhaps what? Even more electoral college victors, but popular vote losers.
Well, David Schultz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Anytime. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with David Schultz, who's a professor of political science at Hamline University and the University of Minnesota School of Law, the author of 30 books. He's the author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Election Law and Democratic Theory, and American Politics in the Age of Ignorance, Why Lawmakers Choose Belief Over Research. We're going to take a brief station break and back look into a new report from the Conservation Biology Institute by 11,000 researchers from around the world published in Bioscience, warning of untold suffering if humanity does not change its ways. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Janet Redmond, the Climate Campaign Director at Greenpeace USA and the former Director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Janet Redmond.
Thanks so much for having me on. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you. And it was bad enough that we learned yesterday that the United States is formally beginning the withdrawal process from the Paris Agreement, which will happen literally on the next election in a year from now. But that coincided, of course, with Trump's threat to Governor Newsom of California to cut off federal funds to fight forest fires and wildfires, which everybody understands is caused or being exacerbated by global warming. But now on top of that, the coincidence is even worse because there's just a new study out from the Conservation Biology Institute that says that more than 11,000 researchers from around the world have issued this grim warning of untold suffering caused by climate change if humanity does not change its ways. So The disconnect is extraordinary. It must be very frustrating for somebody like you.
It is incredibly frustrating. I mean, I think what's really important to remember is that in the U.S., the majority of the American public, by lots of different polling standards, shows us that folks in the U.S. recognize that climate change is a problem, recognize it's real and it's human caused, and that it's urgent and that it requires action. And so while the government that's in office right now is, not just ignoring their problem, but is actively building his campaign and his reputation on climate denial, that's not the view of the majority of the American public. So I think that's one thing we can rest, that can help us rest a little bit easier at night, because what that means is that decision makers, policymakers at the state and local level are still incredibly important in terms of taking the kinds of climate action that Trump is not willing to do. So we can look to that for a little bit of hope, I think, right now. We can also look, frankly, to movements like the Youth Climate Strike, the Sunrise Movement, the really millions of youth around the world who have said enough is enough. This president's time is at some point will be over, recognizing, of course, that it will not be, it potentially will not be soon enough. But I think one thing that we're finding hope is that we see a real shift in the public consciousness and what the public is calling for.
And this report that I mentioned with 11,000 scientists and researchers from around the world issued on Tuesday was published in the journal Bioscience. But prior to that, 16,000 scientists from 184 countries published a letter in 2017 warning that human beings and the natural world are on a collision course. So obviously being in denial is sort of comforting in a way, because the science is pretty grim, is it not? You must have tried to figure out why it is that people are in denial. I mean, there's a cynical reason, and that is that denial has been encouraged by the fossil fuel companies. And the fossil fuel companies, of course, are advertising how much they are investing in wind and algae and all this stuff, most of which is not true. And the value of the fossil fuel companies like ExxonMobil and others is basically based upon how much reserves they have in the ground. And if they get what they have in the ground out of the ground, we're all dead, or the planet's dead. So that's, to my mind, is at least an identifiable problem.
Right. I mean, I think you're right. Part of the thing we have to do is understand the story and then change the story. What we know, what the science tells us, is that climate change is real and here. What we also know is that we can't burn all of the fossil fuels that we even have under production today. If we did that, we would blow way past the Paris Agreement aim of keeping global warming below 1.5, which international scientific bodies has told us is what we have to, that's the limit of warming in the next 10 years if we want to avoid climate disaster. So yes, it is absolutely true that we have been lied to, misled, specifically by the fossil fuel industry companies like Exxon, who knew decades ago that the consequences of their product was going to be global warming, and that meant droughts and food shortages and flooding and internal displacement. So yes, we're fighting against decades of misinformation and outright lying. I think the other piece is really understanding that the kinds of changes we need to make in order to solve the climate crisis are changes we need to make our world a better place anyway. And that's why I feel like some of the excitement around the Green New Deal is really important to talk about. So the Green New Deal, as your listeners may know, is really a concept. It's also in some ways a policy platform, but burst onto the scene the end of last year. And I think it's been incredibly popular because it brings together these ideas of policies that need to lower emissions to keep global warming at safe levels, but also starting to address some of the economic insecurity and racial inequity that we have in this country. So it's also really a jobs program. It's talking about how we rebuild the infrastructure here in the U.S. to provide union family-sustaining jobs in sectors that will help keep us safer from climate change, but will also allow us to drink clean water, access clean water, clean up our air, make sure that our bridges and roads and schools are safe. So I think one of the things that I find really hopeful is that if we can we need to change that story around sacrifice, denial, impending doom, and say we still have some time, but we need to move urgently, and we need to move in a way that builds the broadest possible coalition of forces behind it. And thinking beyond just the carbon fundamentalism, thinking about how we reform our economy, reform the way that we're investing our money in communities and in job creation, so that we're both addressing the climate crisis and we're addressing the crisis of drinking water and public access to public facilities and health care, et cetera. And that to me is a more exciting story. That to me offers some glimmers of hope about how we move forward in a way that builds a broader coalition of the willing to act on climate.
And again, I'm speaking with Janet Redman, the Climate Campaign Director at Greenpeace USA and the former Director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. So in addition to what you said that we have to do, the study that came out today from the 11,000 researchers that's published in Bioscience, it actually says in summary that we need to replace fossil fuels, cut the emissions of climate pollutants such as methane and soot, eat less meat, restore and protect ecosystems, build a carbon-free economy, and stabilize population growth by investing in family planning services and girls' education. Now, we know that the latter is incredibly loaded, is it not, because of all of these sort of right-to-life lobbyists that seem to be able to stop any efforts at reducing the globe's population.
Yeah, I think many of these can be potentially loaded and have been often politicized by the right and by those who have a corporate agenda and are frankly trying to shrink our democratic space. The one that we're most interested in right now is around replacing fossil fuels. There are, like I said, in this Green New Deal proposal, there is a lot of conversation about the clean energy revolution we need to unleash in our economy here and energy efficiency that we can do that's relatively cheap with existing technologies and retrofits, et cetera. But I think that one of the important pieces that has gotten less airtime is really understanding that we have to wind down the fossil fuel industry, which starts with no new expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure. So no new wells, no new pipelines, no new coal mines. And then, of course, we need to couple that with a really robust plan for how the communities and workers who are dependent on the fossil fuel industry transition into new sectors of the economy. But really, until we have an honest conversation about the fact that we need to stop burning oil, gas, and coal, not sometime far off in the future, but really over these next 10 years, we need to make major inroads in phasing down the fossil fuel industry in a responsible way. We can't have an honest conversation about climate action. We have to recognize that climate action is synonymous with a fossil fuel drawdown. We've already seen this kind of start happening actually in the coal sector, where instead of having a managed drawdown process that's responsible and fulfills commitments to workers who have pensions in the coal industry, who depend on the Black Lung Trust Fund to be able to help pay for the diseases that they've accumulated during their decades of work with the coal industry, those companies are frankly going bankrupt right now and leaving communities and workers in the lurch. If we aren't honest about the fact that the sector needs to draw down oil, gas, and coal, this is going to happen again across this country. So we need to start really recognizing that part of what this report tells us, while it's really scary, it tells us that we need to start putting some responsible phase out actions in place around the fossil fuel industry as we ramp up renewable energy, change our ag systems, change the way we eat, and think about how we really bring responsible family planning into play as well.
So at what point do you think the evidence will be so overwhelming? And it is encouraging to see the young kids as young as 10, 15 demonstrating recently in support or following the example of the young Swedish girl Greta Thunberg. And that was really heartening to see that. I drove by lots and lots of kids holding up signs, you know, that we're killing their future. And I like the fact that Greta Thunberg is so uncompromising. And that's all very encouraging. But at some point or other, my feeling is that people like the Koch brothers, who have willfully invested in climate denial in order to make profits, and one of them just died. I don't know what good that does him now that he's in his grave. But at what point do people like the Koch brothers get charged with crimes against humanity?
That's a great question. I mean, we're seeing already criminal cases being brought, civil cases being brought against fossil fuel industries by municipalities. The state of New York right now, the attorney general has more of a fraud case against Exxon and fossil fuel companies. There was an announcement this morning by the county of Honolulu against fossil fuel industry companies for damages related to climate change. We saw Massachusetts launch a similar campaign, a similar lawsuit. So we're certainly seeing suits directed at fossil fuel companies for their lying and their damages caused by their product, which I think is really interesting. I think part of what has to happen also is that the general public has to really understand what the role of corporations is in our democracy, in our media, in our conversation. Right now, we're still seeing advertisements for American Petroleum Institute, Exxon, et cetera, playing in very mainstream, what I think people would call left media. And so until we have messages that are honest and clear, until we're seeing greenwashing by fossil fuel companies completely cut out of credible media sources, credible social media channels, communication channels, it's really hard for people to get an honest and clear view of actually what kinds of steps we need to do moving forward. For example, winding down the fossil fuel industry. I think really one of the things we have to do right now is hold the fossil fuel companies accountable for the damages they knowingly caused. And what's exciting, frankly, about, for example, the Democratic presidential field is that the majority of the leading presidential candidates are talking right now about banning new oil and gas extraction on public lands, for example, on talking about taking away subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, are talking about putting in place a Green New Deal and holding fossil fuel companies accountable. We need to get more information about what exactly those top line messages mean, but it's incredibly encouraging that we've got people contending for the highest office in the country who are actually using language that's that bold. We would have, I couldn't have imagined that a year and a half ago, frankly. So I do think we're seeing some shifts and some desire to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable, and I hope that that will also mean the associations that are often funded by groups like the Koch brothers accountable as well.
Well, just in closing, Janet Redmond, you mentioned the general public, and it would seem to me there are certain things that the general public could do. We know majority of Americans are concerned about global warming and want something to be done. And the state of California was actually doing something in terms of setting standards to reduce air pollution from vehicles and improve gas mileage. Nobody likes breathing polluted air, and nobody likes paying extra at the pump. And yet the Trump administration have reversed that, and they have found allies in the car manufacturers, General Motors, Chrysler, and Toyota, and others. The good guys in this case, the ones that are sticking with California, are Honda, Ford, and BMW. So why not start a boycott of the companies, GM, Chrysler, and Toyota, and others, who rolled over for Trump, and reward companies like Honda, Ford, and BMW?
Yeah, I think corporate campaign is absolutely one of the levers we have to pull. It's incredibly important. We can do it via, whether they're vehicle manufacturers or financial institutions that have made commitments around divestment or agreements not to fund particular kinds of fossil fuel projects, whether it's divestment from universities from fossil fuels or, then also pressuring political targets. Governor Newsom right now is being asked by hundreds of thousands of people across California to put in place, for example, public health setbacks from existing wells and from fracking oil and gas wells to make sure that people don't have to live next to these incredibly polluting sites, and is being asked to stop new oil and gas permitting in the state. So I think there are a number of levers that people can pull, and certainly each of those is incredibly important. We need to be coming at this from all angles. We need political leaders who are willing to be climate leaders and stand up to the fossil fuel industry. We need industry like the tech industry, manufacturing, financial industry to be standing up to the fossil fuel companies as well. There are really a multitude of levers, and I think at this point it's important for people to be campaigning and pulling on as many as we possibly can get. This is an incredibly powerful industry that's been incredibly harmful in undermining our democracy and therefore our ability to actually take climate action at a federal and state level. And we need to be knocking out the pillars that hold it up across society.
Well, Janet Redman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Janet Redman, who is the Climate Campaign Director at Greenpeace USA and the former Director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and engineer D'Angelo Jones. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can bookmark it, sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy this program, make sure you rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And be sure to share the program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And if you are in a position to support us so that we can sustain and build this program, visit us at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Your support will help spread the word and keep us corporate-free, fearless, and independent. And we'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.